hung with Japanese lanterns. A Cajun band played La Jolie Blanche and Allons à Lafayette and Clifton Chenier's signature song, Petite Fille. I sat in my backyard and watched it from across the bayou. A few feet away, I could see the hooded eyes of an alligator among the cattails. Monty Coon was eating from a can of cat food on the picnic table. The band played La Jolie Blanche a second time. For me, there is no more haunting ballad in the world. Its origins go back to the 18th century, but the rendition by Harry Choates is the one that never leaves you. Harry was born in either Rain, Louisiana, or New Iberia, no one ever knew. He composed and sang in French, but didn't know how to speak it. He sold his song for $100 and a bottle of booze and died drunk or was beaten to death by cops in the Austin City Jail. The oddity of Harry's song is that you don't have to speak French to understand it. You know immediately it's about mortality and a lost way of life. Cajun culture is parodied and ridiculed. It is also treated as quaint and commercially exploited and vulgarized. But the travail of the Acadians was real. And so was the love affair of Evangeline on the banks of Bayou Teche, written about by Longfellow. Whenever someone asks me what southern Louisiana used to look like and what has been despoiled by industrial polluters and Louisiana's corrupt politicians, I suggest they listen to Harry's lament. In my opinion, anyone who can be indifferent to this song has a spiritual affliction. I heard Allifair behind me. Monty Coon glanced up and went back to eating. Allifair picked up a pecan that was still in the husk and tossed it at the alligator's head. He ducked under the lily pads, his tail slapping water on the bank. "What's the haps, baby Squanto?" I said. "We have Visigoths in the driveway." I waited, dreading the rest of it. "Tony Nemo," she said. "Who's with him?" "Levon Broussard." "Are you going to work with these guys, Alf?" "I'll do the adaptation with Levon. I won't be on the set." Ouch, I thought. "What's Nemo want?" I didn't ask. "They're drinking champagne in the back of the limo. You want me to blow them off?" I got up from my deck chair. "Nope." I walked into the front yard. The limo was the color of a shark. The back door was open. Levon was standing on the grass, his tie pulled loose, a dark green bottle in his hand.
"I've got a table by the band. I thought you might like to sit with Rowena and me."
I could see Tony's dark massivity piled in the back seat. "No thanks."
"I owe you an amends. Isn't that what you 12-step people call it?"
"You don't owe me anything."
"You're an intelligent, educated man, Dave, but you don't listen. Jimmy Nightingale is going to cause a lot of harm in the world."
"You should know. The guy in the back seat gave him his start in politics."
"Well, Tony doesn't feel that way now."
"Quit lying to yourself," I said. "Lie to yourself, and you're never the same again."
"Say anything of me you wish. I'm going to bring Nightingale down."
"What you're doing is serving a diseased fat slob with a penis for a brain."
"What was that?"
Tony said.
"I'm glad you dropped by," I replied. "I've had a problem of conscience about you." His face looked like a bowl of mashed potatoes. He took a hit from his oxygen cup. Rowena sat next to him, obviously embarrassed. A movie star whose name I won't use sat in the shadows, a champagne glass balanced on his knee. He was handsome in the way that superficial people are, his jaw firm, his teeth capped, his manner easy and detached, as though a greater world awaited his presence.
"What's this about conscience?"
Tony said.
"I think you're in danger," I said. "I think the guy who took out Maximo and Juju and Pookie Domang has you on his list."
"People love me. Why does this guy want to hurt me?"
"Why'd he want to clip Maximo and Juju?" I said.
"They had enemies. I'm not the only guy they work for."
"The killer has a 50 caliber sniper rifle, Tony. It has a box magazine that holds 10 rounds. It's accurate for a mile. I'd stay indoors if I were you."
"Hey, Levon! Let's get out of here," Tony said. "This guy is nuts!"
Nightingale is behind this, Dave, Levon said.
Yeah, I heard he invented original sin, too, I replied.
Good line, he said. Check with you later.
Allifair made a choice against my wishes, I said. Treat her right. Levon tried to smile and let the remark pass, but there was no hiding the injury in his eyes. 1 hour later, he was back in our yard on foot, drunk, his coat gone, his sleeves rolled.
You don't think I'd treat Allifair right, he said. Where do you get off with that?
I turned on the gallery light and went down the steps. Allifair stood in the doorway. Lose the attitude, I said.
You're accusing me of dishonorable conduct.
This isn't about you, it's about my daughter.
She's a grown woman.
Not for me. Not for any father. This isn't 1865. Pull your head out of your ass.
You're wrong, he said.
Wrong about what?
It is 1865. You never quit the field. The battle is never over.
You're going to defeat the forces of evil by joining up with Tony Nemo? Stop being a fool.
A pox on you, Dave Robichaux. You're the one person who should know better.
And that's the way he left it, stumbling down the street, tripping where the sidewalk had been wedged up by giant live oaks, talking to himself. Then he did something I will never understand, nor do I wish to understand, because it truly scared me. He stopped in front of the shadows and stared through its piked fence as though having a conversation with people, perhaps comrades in arms, whom no one else could see. I do not believe it was an illusion on my part, nor do I believe he was deranged. I believed Levon was who he was, and that was what scared me about him. Chapter 27 2 months passed. The man in red tennis shoes seemed to have disappeared. The days were long and hot, the palm fronds and banana plants rattling dryly when the wind blew. Years ago, during the summer, rain showers fell throughout southern Louisiana at almost exactly 3 o'clock every afternoon. Now the gumbo soil in the sugarcane field was baked as hard as ceramic and cracked just as easily. Most people believe that law enforcement and the solving of crimes and the apprehension and prosecution of criminals proceed in a systematic, linear fashion. The opposite is true. A successful outcome is usually produced by informants and dumb luck. The waiting, the missed opportunities, the bureaucracy, the tainted or lost evidence, the witnesses who change their accounts are endless. Lassitude, frustration, and anger become a way of life. Mrs. D'Arthez continued to tell anyone who would listen that I was the murderer of her husband. The prosecution of Levon Broussard for the murder of Kevin Penny crept forward in Jefferson Davis Parish. Location scouts and line producers working for Levon and Tony Nineball began arriving in town with all the attendant excitement. Homer was taken away from Cleet and placed in a foster home, but he ran away and crawled through a window in Cleet's cottage and hid there for 2 days until Cleet returned from his office in New Orleans. So far, the Social Welfare Agency had not tried to take him back. Allifair finished her initial adaptation of Levon's book, then consented to do the polish and to stay on the set after production began. Levon was drunk a lot. I went to meetings. Spade LeBiche stayed in the background and said little, although I still believed that every day was his Ides of March. And no one talked anymore about the Jeff Davis Eight. But while the rest of us were absorbed with our minutiae, Jimmy Nightingale was on the move. He appeared on network morning shows. He was the emissary of the New South, urbane and humble and jocular, a self-deprecating glint of the rogue in his eye. The host or hostess threw him softball questions about his casinos, his oligarchical history, his association with scum like Tony the Squid. He was the aviator who flew biplanes under bridges, an oil man who warned about global warming, an advocate for rural blacks whose neighborhoods were dumping ponds for petroleum waste. One host compared him to the young Bill Clinton, another to the young John F. Kennedy. When Jimmy got finished with an interview, the audience had one reaction, thunderous, heartfelt applause. On a dark night, the clouds crackling with dry lightning, Cleet Purcell was knocking back shots in an end-of-the-line, mixed-race joint in North Lafayette, the kind that had a pine plank bar and red bulbs above the mirrors and where the clientele copulated in their cars without embarrassment. It was set back from the highway in a black neighborhood where some of the streets were still unpaved and desiccated privies still stood in backyards. Cleet had a shot glass and a small pitcher of beer in front of him, and he stood rather than sat at the bar so he could watch the door. The air was thick with smoke. The restroom door open and stinking of urine and ammonia and weed. He could only guess at the race of the people around him. A woman in jeans and boots and a western shirt came through the front door, her black hair tied up with a bandana. He had to rub his eyes with the backs of his wrists to make sure his vision wasn't failing him. She stood next to him and looked around. "This is where you hang out?"
"I'm supposed to meet a skip," he replied.
"What did he skip on?"
"Felony assault. A 50 grand bond. Were you looking for me?"
"I went by the motor court. Homer was alone. He said you were here."
He felt his face burn. "I check on him every 30 minutes.
"He's a nice kid."
"I know that, Miss Sherry. You want a drink?"
"Just a glass."
She tinked a fingernail against the pitcher.
"Let's go over in the corner." God, what a dump.
They sat at a table by a painted-over window, a wood-bladed fan turning overhead. She had carried a clean glass from the bar. He poured it full, the foam running over the edge. He kept his eyes on the door, waiting for a skip who was probably a no-show.
"I've got a bad feeling about the Penny investigation," she said.
"Levon Broussard is going down for it, right?"
"Too many people think Penny got what he deserved. Tony Nineball's influences aren't to be taken lightly either."
"Tony got to somebody?" Cleet said.
"That's why squids have tentacles."
"Dave Robichaud thought the guy in red tennis shoes was going to clip Tony."
"Why?" she said.
"The guy's a cleaner."
"Somebody bigger than Tony Nemo is pulling the strings?"
"Or the agenda is bigger than Nemo's," he said. "Do you know who was the only guy to deal successfully with the mafia?"
"No," she said.
"Mussolini. I grew up in the Irish Channel with those guys. I worked for some of them, in Vegas and Reno and Montana."
Her eyes searched his. "Yeah?"
"They broke my hand with a car door. Later some of them went offline," he said.
"You're a funny guy. I don't mean like strange. You're just a different kind of guy."
Once again, Cleet felt his old enemy come back. As a boy, he'd hated delivering milk off his father's truck to the back doors of the rich in the Garden District. He'd hated the welfare store where the clothes he was given were generic and ill-fitting. He'd hated the cops who'd hauled his parents out of the house when they were drunk and fighting. He'd hated his father for beating him with a razor strop and making him kneel all night on grains of rice. He'd hated a nun who'd told him he was unwashed, and a priest who'd shut the confessional window in his face when he was 12 years old. These moments should have disappeared long ago, but every time Cleet looked into the eyes of a normal person, the dead coals he had carried for decades burst alight, giving life to every dark memory in his unconscious, telling him once again he was worthless in the sight of God and man. "I don't like to talk much about myself," he said. "Not because I'm humble. On my best day, I never got more than a C-. That includes time in the crotch."
"I checked you out. You have the Navy Cross."
"I got it while I was running in the wrong direction. How about we ditch yesterday's box score?"
He tilted the pitcher to fill her glass, but she covered it with her hand. "Sometimes I get the blues," she said. "That's when I know I shouldn't drink too much. If I do, I really get the blues. I like Emmy Lou Harris's line. I got the rhythm, and I don't need the blues."
You're talking about your husband?
He was a West Point graduate. He could have been an academic, but he went to Ranger School. He loved the Army. He was killed by friendly fire.
I'm sorry. He stole a look at her eyes. She was looking at the bar. A man was telling a dirty joke to two women, both of them disheveled, grinning.
You know what I'm saying, don't you?
She asked. I'm not too smart about these things. I'm old, too.
So is the Earth. Is your guy going to show?
Cleet glanced at his watch, the same one he'd owned since the Corps. The hands had a soft green luminosity. Probably not.
I'll buy you a fish sandwich and a cup of coffee at McDonald's, she said.
I don't want to leave Homer alone too long.
Sure,
she said. Another thing. I was involved with this lady. I'm not now, but it wasn't long ago, and she's a nice lady.
The social worker?
She said. Yeah.
She nodded.
You're beautiful, Miss Sherry. You got guts, too. I mean, working with some of those assholes in your department.
I got you. Lay off the personal inventory.
I don't want to walk out of here feeling bad, he said.
Had he just said that? Why did he never have the words that accurately described his feelings?
I didn't mean...
I've got to pee, she said.
When she returned from the women's room, she filled her glass with beer and drank it.
I'd better get going.
How about that fish sandwich, he said.
She followed him to McDonald's in her car. They ate in a booth. Heat lightning flared in the clouds and died somewhere over the gulf. She said little.
He wondered about the images she had seen through the telescopic sight on a sniper's rifle, images she had created with the slow squeeze of a trigger.
You go somewhere in your own head sometimes, she said.
On occasion.
You know what they say?
No, I don't.
Don't go into a bad neighborhood by yourself.
It's the only neighborhood I have, he replied.
She finished her sandwich and wiped her mouth. There was lipstick on the paper napkin when she crumpled it in her hand.
There's a lady who stays over with Homer when I go out of town, he said.
It's your call,
she said. He cupped his cell phone. I'll be outside.
The motel was halfway to Opelousas on the four lane. There was a piney woods behind it and a fountain in front that glittered with pink and blue lights. She followed him there and went into the lobby by his side. During the night, he dreamed of a vill burning, the sparks spinning into the sky. Then the dream changed and he heard the 105s coming in short on his position, a whistling sound like truck tires on a wet highway. When he woke, the ceiling was shaking with thunder. He went into the bathroom in his skivvies and opened the window. The only sound he heard was the wind in the pines, their needles orange with drought and blight. When he went back to bed, he took his snub nose out of its holster and slipped it under his pillow for reasons he didn't understand. Audie Murphy did it, and probably thousands of other guys who never told anybody about it. Why not Cleet Purcell? He lay awake most of the night, trying to provide himself explanations that had eluded him all his life. On a Saturday morning, Alifair came back early from filming outside St. Martinville. She went into the kitchen and took one of my Diet Dr. Peppers out of the icebox and drank it from the can. "Something happened with the Hollywood crowd," I said. "They're mid-level pond scum. Neither good nor bad. Just run-of-the-mill scum."
"So what's the problem?"
"Levon Broussard."
"What's wrong with Levon?"
"He's a closet elitist. Rather than work with conventional film people, he signed on with a bunch of simian throwbacks who hide behind sunglasses and are afraid to talk at the table because they sound like they have throat cancer and a vocabulary of fewer than a dozen words. In the meantime, he pretends."
"Pretends what?"
"That he's on a mission. He insists on hiring only union people. The food has to be of a certain organic quality. The actors should be included in our script meetings. The black actors have to be given more lines.
I think this is all a cover-up for what's really in his head.
What's in his head?
Guilt. Hatred of the truth about his ancestors.
You knew this, Alf, I said.
I didn't know Levon would show up every morning unshaven with booze on his breath and crazy changes in the script.
Maybe it's time to cut loose from these guys, I said.
I don't want to lose my work.
Then don't worry about it.
Levon claims he didn't kill Kevin Penny. I think he's capable of it. I also think he's capable of doing Jimmy Nightingale harm.
You're suggesting Levon might want to kill him?
Levon says Nightingale airdropped explosives on an Indian village in South America and killed women and children. That's not true, is it?
I'm afraid it is, Alf. Jimmy told me about it.
She couldn't hide the look on her face.
At age 5, she had survived an army massacre of her Salvadoran village. The soldiers had used machetes to hack open the bodies of pregnant Indian women.
Why doesn't the media say something about it? She said.
If people don't care about 8 poor women murdered in Jefferson Davis Parish, why would they care about some oil men bombing Indians in Latin America?
Maybe Nightingale deserves a bullet in the face, she said.
I think he's remorseful.
After the fact, she said. What a piece of shit.
Have another diet doc with me, I said.
At least I had one laugh this morning.
At what? I said, glad that we were through with the subject of Jimmy Nightingale and Tony Nemo and Levon Broussard.
This cute little man was behind the cordon when we were filming a scene in St. Martinville. He had on a pale blue baseball cap and clothes out of the box from Penny's. The tags were still on. He looked like a big ceramic doll. He'd read 2 of my novels.
Oh, yeah? I said, my interest fading.
He was eating a fudge bar. He made me think of Truman Capote without the blubber.
Monty Coon was waddling through the backyard side by side with our old warrior cat Snugs.
Are you listening? Allifair asked.
Sure.
I'd love to use him as a character. He was such a cuddly little guy. He said his nickname was Smiley.
Cuddly? I popped a Dr. Pepper and went outside.
Chester drove a compact he had stolen down the bayou road until he saw the refurbished antebellum home of the Nightingales. He passed the driveway and the tunnel of oaks that led to the spacious porch and the second-story balconies and dormers and floor-to-ceiling windows that gave the main house the look of a Baroque paddle-wheeler on the Mississippi. He crossed the drawbridge and parked by a canebrake and lifted the sniper rifle from the trunk and entered an empty boathouse that had a walkway built along one wall. Across the Tesh, he could see the sloping green yard of the Nightingale home and a swimming pool and a bathhouse spangled with sunlight, sifting like spiritual grace through the oak limbs and Spanish moss. Chester also carried a handcrafted leather folder with pockets and braided borders and a bucking horse and cowboy rider stenciled on it. The folder had been given to him years ago by a friend he'd met at a state mental hygiene clinic. The friend had told Chester he'd murdered 3 people while hitchhiking across the country. The friend had considered Chester a man who would understand.
"You shouldn't hurt people who give you a free car ride," Chester had said.
"I needed their car," the friend had said.
"Did you hurt a child? If you lie, you know what will happen."
"I'm sorry, Chester. Don't be mad. I didn't hurt no kids."
"Let's have no more ugly talk."
"No more, I promise."
"That's a good boy,"
Chester had said. His nostrils were flaring, his breath out of control. In the pouches of his folder were his index cards wrapped with a rubber band. The cards were in numerical order. Each one had a drawing on it, depicting the stages of the job he had been assigned. The system never failed him. If you had no connection to the target, and if the target deserved his fate, which they all did, it was easy to walk up on the target with a smile on your face and click the off switch on the side of the target's head and walk away.
He'd done it with an ice pick to a rapist on a subway in New York City, and had covered the dead man's face with a raincoat, and sat in the next car until the train pulled into the station and the body tumbled out of the seat. Of course, there were occasions when he did it in self-defense. When people decided he was a half-grown man they could tease and torment, like the two drug dealers in Algiers, or the deputy who gave him a bad time for simply walking down a back road by the bayou. Chester didn't like to think about those kinds of people. They made him grind his teeth, which were as small and rounded as pearls, and loose in his gums because of the untreated abscesses that were his constant companions in the orphanage. When a dentist warned him about grinding his teeth in his sleep and his obvious need to wear a guard during the nocturnal hours, Chester told the dentist he ground his teeth in the daylight, and the dentist had better watch his greedy mouth and concentrate on keeping his fingernails clean and washing his hands after he went to the bathroom. Chester sat down on a rolled tarp and rested the rifle across his thighs. The sun was white in the sky, the bayou a dirty chocolate color, dragonflies hanging over the cattails. A dead catfish floated upside down past the boathouse, its stomach as bloated as a softball. Then he saw a woman emerge from the back of the house. She was wearing a bathing suit that was as black as her hair. It fit her as tightly and smoothly as molded rubber. He released the box magazine from the rifle's frame and lifted the telescopic sight to his eye. Suddenly the face of the woman was a few feet from his. Her body was an artwork, a landscape of valleys and hills and mysterious places that yearned to be discovered and touched. He felt an erection tightening against his underwear. She walked slowly down the tile steps into the pool, one hand gliding along the hardness of a chromium rail, the water slipping over her knees and thighs and the secret place he knew it was wrong to think about. Through the telescopic sight, he could see the sweat on her neck and the tops of her breasts, and he had to rest the rifle butt down and clench the stock and kiss the barrel to stop his hands from shaking. He closed his eyes and began counting backward from 100 to make his erection go down. Inside his head he saw himself strapped to a bed, his underwear soaked with urine, his bare chest and legs crisscrossed with welts from a switch the operators of the orphanage had made him cut for himself. Then the kindly face of someone not much older than he was appeared above him. Her loving hands unbuckled the straps and removed his soiled underwear and washed his body and stroked his forehead. He forced himself to breathe slowly until he regained control. He wiped his saliva off the gun barrel, his desire reduced to little more than a guttering flame. He must not have impure thoughts, he told himself. They made him want to hurt people. Others enjoyed forbidden things, and he could not. The thoughts followed him around, and the more he tried to keep them out of his head, the more they enticed him. When nothing else worked, he wanted to hurt someone, the way his friend the hitchhiker did, and he never wanted to be like the hitchhiker. He waited for the quivering in his shorts to subside completely. Then he dared look at the swimming pool again. A man in a yellow bikini and flip-flops emerged from the house and walked toward the pool. A towel hung around his neck. Chester lifted the telescopic sight to his eye again. The man's hair was peroxided, his artificially tanned torso plated with muscle, his phallus shaped like a fat banana inside the bikini. Chester put the crosshairs on the man's face. There was something wrong with it. It was sunken in the center, the eyes and nose and mouth too small. It was a stupid face. Chester did not like people with stupid faces. He felt himself grinding his teeth again. Naughty boy, he thought gleefully. The man with the perfect body and stupid face dove into the pool and swam on his back. The woman joined him. Then the two of them rested by the gutter in the deep end, closer than they should have been. Perhaps their legs or stomachs touching. Chester fantasized about parking a big one at the base of the man's brain. It would leave his head floating in chunks, dissolving like red smoke in the turquoise depths. Chester ran his tongue across his lips at the thought. The woman pulled herself up on a ladder and got out of the pool, her rump dripping. She seemed very angry and shook her finger at the man clinging to the pool gutter, his face turned up to hers. Chester wondered if the man with the stupid face had tried to put his hand somewhere he shouldn't have. If that was true, Chester wanted to kill him. And not all at once. Bad men deserved bad things, and Chester knew how to do all of them. He began to breathe heavily again, frustrated with himself and with the restraints placed upon him. He shouldn't have come here, or wheeled his suitcase down the two-lane road by the bayou, thereby drawing the attention of the deputy he was forced to kill. The job and the places were always on the cards. There were no cards that showed him in a boathouse, gripping an M107 with both hands. But these were things he had to do, whether others liked them or not. He had survived at the orphanage and on the streets of Mexican border towns where children were rented by the hour. Today he had power that he wanted to take back in time and use on all those who had exploited his little body. But that was not the way it worked. Time did not take away the pain, nor did it allow him to use his skills on people out of the past who waited for him in his sleep. Chester got up and realized there was a wet spot the size of a quarter in his underwear. Although no one was in sight, he felt his face burning as he walked back to the car and dropped the rifle into the trunk. He drove straight to a Dairy Queen in Franklin and cleaned himself in a restroom, then sat at a wooden table in the shade and began eating a paper plate full of ice cream sandwiches. Three teenagers sat in an SUV 10 feet away, the doors open, the panels throbbing with rap. "Turn that down, please," Chester said. A kid lowered the volume. "What was that?" "That music. It hurts my ears," Chester said. "It grows on you," the kid said. He turned the volume up full blast. Chester walked to the door of the SUV. The three kids were looking at one another and grinning as though they intuitively knew a lifelong object of ridicule had wandered into their midst and they were free to do anything they wished to him. "Why do you want to act smart, Alecky?" Chester shouted above the roar. "You like dilly bars?" said the kid in the passenger seat. "Strap on your knee pads in the restroom. I'll bring you one."
"Don't talk like that.
My father owns half this town. Now get out of here, freak."
Chester rested one hand on the door like a lump of dough.
"You shouldn't say that to me." "Oh, he's all mad now," the kid said, forming his mouth into a pout.
"He messed himself. He's starting to cry."
"He's a retard," the driver said. "Leave him alone."
"He's cute," said the kid in the passenger seat. "We like you, little buddy. Want to meet some girls?"
"You're very mean," Chester said.
"We're finished here,"
the driver said. He leaned toward the passenger window.
"You hear me? Get your hand off the door."
When Chester didn't move, the driver smashed his hand.
"Owie,"
Chester said. The three kids laughed. Chester got behind the wheel of his vehicle. He started the engine, but could not hear its sound and had to rest his hand on the dashboard to make sure it was running. He had entered one of those soundproof moments in his life that belonged to neither the past nor the present. The catalyst and the consequence were always the same. Contempt, ridicule, public shame, followed by his eardrums swelling so tightly he couldn't hear, and his optical nerves popping loose from the backs of his eyes, deconstructing the external world piece by piece. For perhaps 30 seconds, the backs of his eyelids were a red veil, on the other side of which Stick figures performed gross acts and fought one another with staves and staffs, like the caricatures in tarot cards. It was funny how life replicated the tarot rather than the other way around. Maybe that was how thought worked. You had the thought, then the thought became the thing. That was why bad thoughts were to be avoided. The moment passed, and the world reassembled itself, and Chester drove into the street and down to the intersection. 10 minutes later, the three boys in the SUV pulled out and drove in the opposite direction. They stopped at a girl's house, a filling station to gas up, a street corner in a black neighborhood to score some weed, a drive-through window for daiquiris, a gun and ammo store to buy 22 shells. They parked by swampy woods used as an illegal dump and took turns parking holes in a rusted-out car body that had no engine and no glass in the windows. When they were out of shells, they got back into the SUV and big-fired a bong. Chester estimated the range at 800 yards. With his gloves on, he loaded 9 armor-piercing rounds into the box magazine, then wet the 10th round with his mouth and inserted it with the others. He braced the bipod on the car hood and sighted through the scope. Inside the SUV, the silhouettes of the boys moved back and forth like cutouts on a moving clothesline. He felt a flame lick at his loins, a hardening again in his manhood, a desire that went so deep he knew he would never satisfy it. His ears whirred with sound, his heart pounded, and just as he squeezed the trigger, he felt a dam break inside him, and an orgasmic sensation flood through his body, so strong and warm and encompassing that his legs went weak. There was no movement inside the SUV, nor any sound. The round had punched a hole just below the rear window and probably gone through the seats and the radio. Chester kept the rifle aimed at the same level and delivered 4 more rounds, blowing pieces of the seats and upholstery and dashboard and windshield onto the hood. His last shot was into the gas tank. He picked up his brass and dropped it into the pockets of his baggy trousers. Before he pulled onto the asphalt, he glanced through the rear window. One of the kids had spilled onto the ground. One was running through the woods. Chester didn't know where the third had gone. He turned up the air conditioning until the inside of the car was frigid and the sweat on his face turned to ice. He thumbed a CD of Brahms into the stereo and took a deep breath through his nose, as though inhaling air off a glacier on the first day of creation. Long before a thick-legged quadruped with fins and gills and lungs waddled out of the surf and began its agenda. Chapter 28. Helen came into my office on Tuesday morning. She had just gotten back from the sheriff's department in St. Mary Parish. She told me of the shooting. "None of the boys were hit," I said. "That's what's peculiar," she said. "The shooter clustered 5 rounds below the rear window and put 1 in the gas tank. Why didn't he riddle the whole vehicle if he was out to do maximum damage?" "How far away was he?" "Far enough that the boys never saw him. By the way, boys isn't a good term for these guys. They're walking promotions for Planned Parenthood." "No brass?" "Just tire tracks," she said. "They may belong to a stolen car that was found in Des Allemands." "You think this is our guy?" I asked. "He was obviously using a high-powered military rifle and probably firing armor-piercing rounds. The kids don't have any idea who was shooting at them or why. They say a weirdo guy was yelling at them at the DQ. "About what?" "Their radio was playing rap. That was a couple of hours before the shooting. I don't think they were just playing rap either." "They wised off?" "Who knows? They'd drown in their own shit if they ever left St. Mary Parish," she said. "What kind of car was the guy at the DQ driving?" "They just remembered it was green, like the stolen one in Des Allemands." "Any latents?" "The owners," she said. "You think the shooter just wanted to scare the hell out of them?" "He parked one in the tank." "Maybe he didn't want them coming after him," she said. "Or he wanted to burn them alive," I said. "No, I think our boy lost control and went outside his parameters."
like somebody rolling the dice and shutting his eyes. Charlie Manson claims he never killed anyone. That's because he got somebody else to do it.
I said earlier that Cleet Purcell was the best investigative detective I ever knew, but Helen Swallow was a close second. What did the guy at the DQ look like, I asked.
Chubby buttocks? A lisp? The kind of guy who hangs around playgrounds?
I think these kids have sexual problems of their own, I said.
Before they got into it, they said the guy was smiling at everybody in the DQ, particularly at children.
The kind of guy somebody might call smiley?
I think this baby is back in town and ready to rock, she replied.
Sometimes it is hard to explain to outsiders the culture of southern Louisiana and the quandary of many of its people. The world in which they grew up is now a decaying memory, but many of them have no place in the present. I know Cajuns who have never been farther than two parishes from their birthplace. There are people here who cannot add and subtract, cannot read a newspaper, and do not know what the term 9/11 means. Over 40% of children are born to an unwed mother. In terms of heart and kidney disease, infant mortality, fatal highway accidents, and contaminated drinking water, we are ranked among the worst in the nation. Our politicians are an embarrassment and give avarice and mendacity a bad name. So how do you get angry with someone who was born poor, speaks English so badly that she's unintelligible to outsiders, has the world view and religious beliefs of a medieval peasant, cleans houses for a living if she's lucky, and is obese because of the fat-laced bulk food she feels thankful for? The temperature had hit 98 degrees at 4 in the afternoon. The humidity was eye-watering and as bright as spun glass, as tangible as lines of insects crawling on your torso and thighs. At sunset, lightning pulsed in the clouds over the gulf, but no rain fell, and the wind was dry and hot and smelled of road tar and diesel fuel. I walked down to the bayou and watched the sun shrink into an ember between two black clouds and disappear. Then the wind died, and the trees stood still, and the surface of the bayou quivered in the sun's afterglow, as though a molecular change were taking place in the water. It's a phenomenon that seems unique to South Louisiana, like a sea change, as if the natural world is reversing itself and correcting an oversight. The barometer will drop unexpectedly. The bayou will swell and remain placid at the same time. And suddenly, rain rings will dimple the surface from one bank to the other. Fish sense the change in barometric pressure and begin feeding on the surface in anticipation of the rain that will wash food from the trees into the stream or swamp. The wind sprang to life just as a solitary raindrop struck my face. I went back into the house to get Alifair. Come outside. What's going on? She said. It's actually raining. Let's walk down to Clementine's for dessert. She was writing in longhand at her work table, a flat-sided oak door I had nailed onto sawhorses. She looked out the window. The light was almost gone, and leaves were scattering across the yard, and Monty Coon was standing stiff-legged on top of Tripod's hutch, his nose pointed into the wind.
Wonderful, Alifair said, and capped her pen.
As we stepped out onto the gallery, we saw a short, stocky woman in a dark dress walk at an angle across Main, carrying a hand-lettered sign, undaunted by the whir of the automobile tires whizzing past her. Her shoulders were humped, the muscles in her calves shaped like upside-down bowling pins, her expression as angry as an uprooted rock. The sign read, Guy Robichaud killed my husband and was let free. How am my family going to live?
Let me talk to her, Dave, Alifair said. I'll do it, I said. My expression of confidence was vanity. There in the dying light, trapped in her own rage and madness and the heat radiating through the soles of her cheap shoes, her hair tangled wetly on her face, raindrops spinning down from the stars above oak trees planted by slaves, dredged out of a 16th-century mob armed with pitchforks and rakes, Mrs. T.J. D'Artes
had persevered through time and history and the elements and brought her war to my doorstep and, worse, confronted me again with the bête noire I could not exorcise from my life. I tried to place my hand on her arm.
"Don't touch me, you," she said. "Liar, killer, fille putain."
"Don't be talking about my mother, Miss D'Ortez," I said.
"I seen the preacher at our church. He said I got to forgive. Not Detective Roberts, though, I don't. That's what I told him, yeah? Ain't nothing in the Bible say we got to forgive evil, and that's what you are."
"I didn't kill your husband."
"How you know that if you say you were so drunk you didn't know what world you was in? My man was sick. He didn't have no money for his prescriptions. He couldn't protect himself."
"What prescriptions?"
"For his epilepsy. His truck was ruined, and he couldn't work because of the accident and because the insurance company wouldn't give him no money."
"That's not true, Ms. D'Ortez," Allifair said.
"You stay out of it, you."
"Let us drive you home," I said.
"I ain't taking no favors from y'all. God gonna get you, Mr. Roadshow. I'm gonna stay out here all night. Then I'm gonna stay out here all day tomorrow."
"No, you will not," I said.
"You ain't gonna boss me, no."
"I wouldn't try to do that," I said. "I think you're a good lady, Ms. D'Ortez. I think someone used your husband to bring me harm."
"It was you," she said. "It's all been you."
"No, ma'am. It's not me," I said. A raindrop struck her forehead and ran through one eyebrow and across her nose like silver thread. But she never blinked, and she did not try to wipe the water from her face.
"Why you done this to me? I ain't got nothing except two hungry kids, me."
I put a hand on each of her shoulders, whether she liked it or not. "My wife, Annie, was murdered. So was my mother. My father was killed by an oil well blowout that shouldn't have happened. I know what it feels like to be treated badly by the world. That is why I would never deliberately hurt you or your husband. Look into my face and tell me I'm lying."
"I ain't got to do nothing, you say."
"No, you don't. But what does your conscience tell you? Forget about the preacher at your church, good man that he might be. Forget about me. Forget about every other person in the world except you and your children and your own idea of God. What does your conscience tell you?" She faltered.
"I ain't sure."
"No, tell me, Miss D'Ortez. Tell me now." I squeezed her shoulders tighter. Tears were welling in her eyes. She shook her head. "Say it."
"You're telling the truth."
"Thank you," I said. She dropped the sign on the grass.
"What am I going to do, sir?"
"Whatever it is, Allifair and I will help you with it." She buried her face into my chest, her hands at her sides. I could feel the wetness coming through my shirt. "I'll be inside," Allifair said. "Are you okay, Miss D'Ortez?" I said.
"No, sir, I ain't. I ain't never gonna be okay. Never, never, never."
She ground her forehead deeper into my chest, into the bone. Considering the hand she'd been dealt, who would take her to task? At noon on Wednesday, Cleet was about to go across the street to Victor's cafeteria when a midnight blue Buick with tinted windows pulled to the curb and a chauffeur in gray livery got out and looked across the roof at Cleet and said,
"Got a minute, Mr. Purcell?"
Peroxide hair, dented-in face, shades, flat stomach, concrete deltoids, scar tissue around the eyes, a half cup of brains. Where had he seen him before? "You're Swede Jensen. You parked cars at the casino."
"You got a good memory," the chauffeur said. "I work for Miss Nightingale now."
"I'm closed till one."
"She gave me orders. I told her you probably didn't want to be bothered. She pissed in the swimming pool about it. How about cutting me a break?"
Cleet tried to process what he'd just heard. It was impossible. "Come in and make it fast." He went back into the office and closed the blinds. His secretary had already gone to lunch. The waiting area was empty. He sat behind his desk and opened a drawer and took out a roll of mints and put one into his mouth. He left the drawer open. A 25-caliber semi-auto lay under a notepad. Swede took a chair.
"She wants to hire you,"
he said. "So why doesn't she come in?"
"She's shy."
"I'll believe that in a minute."
"I told her we go back."
"We don't go back, Swede. I remember you. That's a long way from we go back."
"This is my meal ticket, Purcell."
"Before Tony Nineball got you a job parking cars, you were a porn actor in that studio out on Airline Highway." Sweet took off his shades and pinched the bridge of his nose. His eyes were blue, one of them defective, as if there were an ice chip in the lens.
"I took a pinch for a lewd act with a minor. I had to wait 8 months in jail to go to court. The charges got dropped. You want me to leave? That's fine with me."
"What's on Ms. Nightingale's mind?"
"She thinks Slevon Broussard's lawyers are going to put the Kevin Penny torture murder on her brother."
"Why would they want to do that?" Cleet asked.
"What do you think? To break his sticks."
"So he can't get elected to the U.S. Senate?"
"The Senate is just a rosin box," Swede said. "Jimmy Nightingale is the man for our times."
"I knew a mobbed-up guy from Jersey who knew Nightingale in the casino business. He's doing life for tying a guy to a tree and shooting him in the balls. He said Nightingale was a Murphy artist without the virtues."
"Go to one of his rallies. All those people are wrong?"
Cleet looked at Swede again. His eyebrows were irregular and shaped like earthworms that had been stepped on. "You were in the ring?"
"Ham and egg stuff. Nothing to write Ring magazine about."
"Where'd you learn to fight?"
"Inside, when I was 18. The Nightingales gave me a break, like they have a lot of people. Here's the gig. $2,000 a month retainer, probably for a year."
"Retainer to do what?"
"To swat flies. This place is bumfuck on acid. You know the kind of dirt that people are trying to dig up on Mr. Nightingale?"
"Tell Ms. Nightingale to call me."
"She's waiting for you now."
"Where?"
"You got a problem with food from Popeyes?"
"No."
"She's in the park."
"Don't do it," a voice said. "I'll follow you," Cleet said. He drove his caddy onto the grass by a concrete boat ramp and a row of camellia bushes on the water's edge. Emmeline was sitting under the roof of a picnic shelter wearing a sundress and a wide-brimmed straw hat with silk flowers sewn on it, like one from the plantation era. She and Swede had spread a check cloth on the table and placed there a bucket of fried chicken and one of fried crawfish and a box of buttermilk biscuits with a container of milk gravy. Cleet removed his pork pie hat and sat down. "How do you do, ma'am?" he said.
"You're as big as they say," she said.
"My stomach?"
"A big guy is a big guy," she said.
"Swede says you want some help."
"I don't want Jimmy stabbed in the back."
"Who wants to do that?"
"Levon Broussard, the savior of humanity," she said. She pushed the bucket of fried crawfish toward him.
"Got a soft drink?"
he asked. "You don't want a long neck?"
Swede asked. Emmeline's eyes drilled a hole in Swede.
"Coca-Cola coming up,"
he said. "So you want Levon Broussard off your case?" Cleet asked Emmeline.
"Or tied to an anchor and thrown in the Gulf," she said. "That's a joke."
"I don't think the guy's got a lot of arrows in his quiver."
"What do you call an abomination like Tony Nemo?"
she asked. "I don't like to say this, but Fat Tony poured most of your brother's concrete."
"Nemo poured half the concrete in New Orleans," she replied.
Cleet took a long sip from his Coke, his eyes veiled. What was she after? Now she was talking about oil companies, their mistreatment of Jimmy, the unfair role they'd placed him in South America, the stupidity of the media, the hypocrisy of Levon, the vile nature of his wife. "How's Broussard a hypocrite?" Cleet asked. "He did a lot of good down in Latin America, didn't he? With Amnesty International and that kind of stuff." He can't write or talk enough about his glorious ancestors who happened to be slave owners. Then he bleeds all over the television screen about the suffering people in Guatemala. In the meantime, his Aborigine wife tells everybody who listened that Jimmy raped her.
She's an Aborigine, Cleet said.
She looks like one.
You're not going to go jogging with her, he said.
Did I misjudge you?
Do you mean am I dumb instead of smart? Yeah, probably.
That's not clever, Mr. Purcell. You have a good reputation as a private investigator. But I don't think you understand how vicious Jimmy's enemies are. You also don't know how good a man he is.
Right, Cleet thought. He took another sip from his Coke. How far should he take it? Swede mentioned a retainer of $2,000 a month, he said. That's a lot of money for what sounds like doing nothing.
There would be a few duties, she said.
Like what?
Security, maybe.
He picked up a biscuit and dipped it in the gravy and put it into his mouth, his cheek pouching. His eyes remained empty as though he were detached from the conversation. Has Dave Robichaud got anything to do with it?
No. Why would he be involved in anything regarding Jimmy? Actually, I don't care for Mr. Robichaud.
Don't take this personal, Ms. Nightingale. When a guy like Tony the Squid can't get a cop on a pad, he goes to a friend of the cop. Maybe he wines and dines the cop, then lends him money. The issue is information. Any place there's vice, extortion, blackmail, union corruption, insider trading, jury rigging, highway contracting, the issue is always information. The rest of it doesn't mean diddly squat on a rock. Outside of the scut work I do for bail bondsmen, I make my living off information. I'm not proud of it.
Your perception is correct, she said.
About what?
I want to retain you to keep me informed about people who want to hurt my brother, she said. Got it?
I don't do wiretaps. I don't do videos through windows, and I don't deliberately mess people up, not even the lowlifes.
I don't expect you to, she said.
Let me think on it.
You've taken up this much of my time, and you'll think on it?
Cleet looked at the glare of the sun on the water. It resembled a yellow flame dancing under the chop from a passing boat. I got a big enemy, my own head, so I got to think through things before I make choices. Then I usually make the wrong choice anyway. And then I got to think my way back to it a second time. And it's not only a drag, I get a bad headache.
She gazed into space as though she had been listening to someone speaking Sanskrit.
Hello? He said.
Yes.
Could I have a couple of these crawfish for the road? He asked.
I can't believe I've had this conversation, she said.
1 hour later, Cleet looked out the back window of his office and saw Swede Jensen on his patio, where Cleet kept a reclining chair and a spool table outfitted with a beach umbrella. Swede was tossing his chauffeur's cap into the air and catching it. Cleet opened the French doors and stepped out into the heat.
You trying to creep my office?
Miss Nightingale is picking up her Lexus at the dealership. I got a question. Are you on the inside with the Robichaud girl?
Time to use your words carefully, Swede.
You got me wrong. You said something about me working in a porn studio. Maybe there was some porn made there, but I wasn't part of it.
I'll contact the Vatican so they can get started with your early canonization.
I was in 2 independent films. They made it into a few legitimate theaters.
Yeah, Cleet said.
I'll tell you something else. The porn guy on airline? He almost nailed the hijackers before 9/11. He tried to get a hold of somebody at the FBI. He said the ragheads buying dirty films from him weren't religious fanatics. They were degenerates and rod-floggers like most of his clientele. The message got lost or delayed or something. A few days later, the towers and the Pentagon got hit. True story. So how about it?
How about what?
Will you put in a word for me with Robichaud's daughter? She's the screenwriter for the Civil War film. I'm a pretty good actor. I just want a shot.
I'll ask her.
No kidding.
I'll tell her you're available.
You're okay, Purcell. Not like what I'm always hearing.
Do me a favor.
Anything,
Sweet said. Keep the